الحمد لله والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وبعد. For those of you who were not here last time, Donald Mustafa. This is what they have actually for the three. If you remember last time you were there, we went over the levels of knowledge, and I think it wasn't that clear in English, so I made this for last time. So last time we said that since we'll be in the mosque and we'll have less time, the nature of the lecture today is going to be different from what we'd usually have over there. This is like a footnote to the class. Today's lecture, inshallah, and Thursday's lecture will be about Sahihain, yani the collections of Sahih al-Bukhari and Sahih Muslim. Basically, yani if we have time, here's what we're going to cover. We're going to cover the lives of al-Bukhari and Muslim, and then the particular characteristics of each work, and then a comparison between the two, Bukhari and Muslim. And then we'll cover the criticisms of Sahih Bukhari and Sahih Muslim. Okay. And then the thing that inshallah we'll be heading towards is the level of knowledge that the hadith of Sahih Bukhari and Sahih Muslim carry. Okay, so it goes back to the thing that we were discussing last week, inshallah.
Level of knowledge, you mean by the matan?
Level of knowledge, you were not here. And the ulama of usul, they divide knowledge into different categories, different ranks. For example, there's ilm al-yaqini al-dhururi, wa ilm al-yaqini al-nadhari, wa dhan al-rajih, wa dhan al-marjuh, wa shak. We went over all of them last Tuesday, I think.
You have a copy of the English?
Of the English? I had two copies. I already gave them out. And the reason we brought up this topic is because last time when we ended, there was a question about Sahih al-Bukhari and Sahih Muslim, and if someone says the hadith there are weak. That's how come we ended up with this topic. So I think if we realize what Sahih Bukhari and what Sahih Muslim are about, and what they actually are, this will increase our appreciation of those two works, and it will increase our certainty that what they have is correct. I'd like to begin just with something very light, and that's the life of the biography of the two imams. And with respect to Imam Bukhari, there's lots of information that you can find. With respect to Imam Muslim, there's very little information. I don't know why there's such a difference, except for, well, one reason for the difference is because Imam Bukhari, and for one reason or another, near the end of his life, he became, unfortunately, a rather controversial figure.
Bukhari,
yeah. And as you probably know, he even made dua for his death, and for Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to take him. And because of this controversy, many things are known about al-Bukhari. While Muslim lived a very simple, scholarly life, we could say. Al-Bukhari's name is Abu Abdullah Muhammad ibn Ismail ibn Ibrahim al-Bukhari al-Ju'fi. And he was born in 194 after the Hijrah.
Again.
If you know Abu Abdullah Muhammad ibn Ismail, that's sufficient. I have a phone call. Please. He was born in the year 194. Well, his father was a well-respected scholar, and he was one of the students of Imam Malik, and also one of the students of Hamad ibn Zayd.
One of the well-known scholars in
Hadith? In Hadith also, yeah.
Yeah.
That's Ismail. But unfortunately, he died when Imam Bukhari was very young. So yani, it was not the case that he was able to take hadith from his father, from Imam Malik, back to the Prophet ﷺ. He died, as I said, while Imam Malik was very young, but he also left while Imam Bukhari was very young, and he also left Imam Bukhari a large fortune, at least large enough that Imam Bukhari did not have to yani, worry about making a living. This is proof, yani, he was not living in days like today. He began, obviously, his studies at a very young age, which was traditional back then. You learn first the Quran and the Arabic language, and then you move on to other topics. At a young age, he had already shown that he was he liked to read quite a bit, and he liked to memorize quite a bit. He read the books of Waqi' and Abdullah ibn al-Mubarak, and he memorized them. And these are books of hadith. But in order to memorize them better, and he didn't just memorize the isnad, but what he did is he studied everyone in the isnad. When did he live? Where did he live? Where did he travel to? When did he die? Who were his students? Who were his sheikh? So it's not just a bunch of names. And if you memorize the isnad, to you, yani, it might be a bunch of names. But if the names of the isnad are people that you know, like Ali al-Hakami or Muhammad Zayed, don't know what grade of hadith this is going to be, a knife. Yani, if there are people that you know, it makes it easier to know the isnad. And because the people in the chain are actually people that you know, so therefore you memorize them. And that was one of the benefits of what al-Bukhari did, by learning yani, intimately everyone in the chain, when did they live, where did they live, when did they die, and so forth. After reading many books, he started to attend the lectures in Bukhara. And one time he went to one of the sheikh's lectures. The sheikh was, his name was Al-Dakhili. He was one of the well-known muhaddithin in Al-Bukhara. Where the sheikh read a hadith with the chain Sufyan from Abu Zubair from Ibrahim. Al-Bukhari told him that he was wrong. That was a mistake. Al-Dakhili was surprised. This person,
Al-Dakhili,
alif after the dal. And he was surprised by this person correcting him. The Bukhari told him that the correct chain was Zubair ibn Adi instead of Abu Zubair, because he said that Abu Zubair never recorded hadith from Ibrahim, and so therefore it was a mistake. And he told Al-Dakhili that if you have the source and if you have the written work, go and check it. Well, he did, and he admitted his mistake. Well, Imam al-Bukhari at that time was 11 years old when he corrected the sheikh. At the age of 16, and which was again normally the case, that you live in a city and you learn the hadith or the knowledge of the people of your city, and then after that you begin to travel. So at the age of 16, he went to Mecca to make Hajj with his mother and his brother. And he stayed in Mecca, and this is where his traveling began. He stayed in Mecca for at least 5 years. And during that time, although he was quite young, he wrote a book called Tariq al-Kabir, which is a large, right now, and he published, it's about 9 volumes, collection of narrators. And he wrote it at about the age of 18 or 19. It's a book of narrators. And everyone, Ismail Rajal, Fulan, he lived this time, he died this time, these were his students, these were. And he said with every narrator that he has in the book, he could give a story for every narrator. But he doesn't want to make the book too long.
He has 9 volumes and he doesn't want to make the book.
Hey, so you can imagine how long it would be if he... and this, to this day... Hey.
Now 9 volumes, right?
9 volumes, what do you mean by one book?
When you said, was it 9 volumes since he wrote it?
I don't know how he kept it together. Like, and now it's 9 volumes. It's the same book.
No,
it's published in Pakistan without any tahqiq or anything. Even no spaces, just 9 volumes. Wa alaykum as salaam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Well, during this time also, after By the way, that work still is one of the classic works of Asma' al-Rijal. And although he wrote it in his youth, to this day it's still considered one of the classic works, and it's still referred to by all of the muhaddithin since his time. Well, obviously, he traveled to other areas. He traveled to Egypt, to Sham, to Kufa, to Baghdad.
What's his father?
Ahmed?
Yeah.
He went back home with his mother. Well, we don't hear anything about him again yet. His mother and his brother went back to Bukhara. Also, by the way, in Baghdad, this is where he first met Ahmed ibn Hanbal. No, this is after, after staying 5 years in Mecca, he traveled to the other parts of the Muslim world.
What did he start with?
I don't know. This is what he said. Okay, I visited Asham, Egypt, and Al Jazeera. Al Jazeera, that time, is referring to, it's between Syria, Iraq, and Turkey. He said, I visited these areas twice. 4 times I went to Basra. I stayed in the Hijaz for 6 years. And I don't know how many times I visited Kufa and Baghdad along with the scholars of Hadith. So he doesn't say which one he did first, but these are the places that he visited.
Did he say that he visited Egypt?
Yes. I visited Sham, Egypt, and Al Jazeera twice. In Baghdad, this is where he met Ahmed ibn Hanbal. Ahmed ibn Hanbal was very much impressed with Imam al-Bukhari. And he was very sad that every time Imam al-Bukhari would leave to Bukhara. And he said, why should you? At that time, Baghdad was maybe the center of learning. So Imam Ahmed tried his best to convince Sheikh al-Bukhari, Imam al-Bukhari, to stay. But every time he left. But if you look at Sahih al-Bukhari, you'll only find one hadith that Imam Bukhari narrated directly from Imam Ahmed. You'll only find Ahmed's name twice in Sahih al-Bukhari. One time directly from Ahmed, another time through somebody else. And the reason for that is that when al-Bukhari used to go to Baghdad, he used to get the hadith from the teachers of Imam Ahmed directly. And in other words, he did not have to rely on Imam Ahmed. Because he would go there and he would meet Imam Ahmed's teachers. So therefore, he would take the same hadith from his teachers. And later in his life, later in Imam Ahmed's life, after the fitna, after the fitna that Imam Ahmed had to go through with respect to whether the Quran is created or not. After that time, Imam Ahmed stopped narrating hadith. And after he was punished, he stopped narrating hadith. So the later years when al-Bukhari went to Baghdad, Imam Ahmed was no longer narrating hadith. So he did not get a chance to continue to take hadith from Imam Ahmed. As opposed to Ali ibn al-Madini, who was about the same time as Imam Ahmed, al-Bukhari took many hadith from him, because during the whole time he was continually... Why did he stop exactly? It's not clear. But it seems he had gotten to the point, because of the situation there, that he kind of went into retirement.
Wasn't he asked by the Khalifa?
To stop? No, this is after the Khalifa. After the persecution and the Khalifa died, the other Khalifa had nothing against Imam Ahmed. But he just, for some reason, he went into retirement. Well, Sheikh Al-Azmi right now is trying to do some research to find out exactly about Imam Ahmed and why exactly he stopped.
No?
Sheikh Al-Azmi. Mustafa Al-Azmi. Well, Bukhari's teachers, Ibn Hajar, he divides them into five categories. The first category are those who heard hadith from the tabi'in or from the followers. These are the teachers of Bukhari. So the first categories are those who took hadith directly from the tabi'in. And in other words, they are the tabi'in. This would include for example, Muhammad ibn Abdullah al-Ansar, even Ibrahim, and so on. And I assume some of you are not familiar with these names, so I will not go over them. So what that means is that the shortest chain that al-Bukhari has is from these people. From the Tabi'in, from the Sahaba to the Prophet ﷺ. That is the shortest chain that he has. And there's some hadith in Sahih Bukhari with this chain, yani with this short of a chain. And some scholars have taken them out of al-Bukhari and made a separate work. They are over 100 in number with this short chain. There are some, the next category of scholars are people who, yani they met some of the tabi'in, but they did not record any hadith from the trustworthy tabi'in. So in other words, for these people, yani the chain is not this short.
Why didn't they record it?
Ma'am?
Didn't you record it directly?
They didn't have any hadith from trustworthy tabi'in. Yani the tabi'in they met were not trustworthy. The next category is al-Bukhari's main teachers. Yani. You could say. These are the people, they did not meet any of the tabi'in, but they were yani, people of knowledge. These include, as I said, his main teachers, Ali ibn al-Madini. Yani, these people did not meet any of the tabi'in. In other words, they are from tabi'in.
That's fourth category.
It's the third category, which Ibn Hajar calls it the intermediate category. I don't know why he calls it that. This includes Sulaiman ibn Harb, Ali ibn al-Madini, Yahya ibn Ma'in, Ahmed ibn Hanbal, Ishaq ibn Rahaway, although the Muhaddithin do not like it if you pronounce it like that. It should be Ishaq ibn Rahuya, according to the Muhaddithin. Wa Abu Bakr and Uthman ibn Abu Shayba. Yes, Abu Bakr and Uthman, both of them are Ibn Abu Shayba. Brothers.
No, the first category,
mm-hmm.
they heard directly from Tabi'in.
Yes,
right?
Yes.
And those, the third one.
The third one did not meet the Tabi'in. See, the first one met Tabi'in and took hadith from authentic, trustworthy Tabi'in.
So they are Tabi'in.
They are Tabi'in, yeah. The second category met Tabi'in but did not meet any Thaqa Tabi'in. So they're also Tabi'in. The third category is what Taba squared Tabi'in. Taba.
But you said
it's Tabi'in.
Tabi'in.
Hey, the third one, yeah. Did I say that?
Yeah. What, can we say that?
No, he said the
weak chain or what?
No. It's not a matter of weak or not, it's just it's getting longer. The next category are his colleagues, yani people who are about the same age as him, who he also used to take hadith from and so forth. This includes Muhammad ibn Yahya al-Dhuhli. We'll come back to him. Abu Hatim al-Razi. And others. And the fifth category are those who are younger than al-Bukhari. Because there's a statement among the muhaddithin that yani, you will not become a complete scholar unless you take from those greater in status than you, those of equal status, and those of lesser status. So, yani, he used to take hadith from people younger than him.
How does that imply? Status and not age?
Status and age, yani, both. Yeah. Well, Bukhari, for example, in Sahih al-Bukhari, you'll find one hadith from his student at-Tirmidhi. Well, at-Tirmidhi was very proud of this fact. He used to brag about the fact that one of his hadith there... Tirmidhi, of Sunan fame, as I wrote here. And al-Bukhari's students also are very, very famous. They include at-Tirmidhi, who has the collection Sunan al-Tirmidhi, and Nasa'i, who has the collection Sunan al-Nasa'i. No. Now I'm talking about yani, his students. These are all, yani, as you'll see, yani, his students are more well-known probably than most of his teachers. At-Tirmidhi, al-Nasa'i, Muslim ibn al-Hajjaj, the one who collected Sahih, Jami' al-Sahih. Ibn Khuzaymah, who also has the Sahih, which is somewhere around here. Here it is. Ibn Khuzaymah. Abu Zar'a al-Razi, one of the scholars in Ilil or defects of Hadith. وأبو حاتم الرازي.
ابن ماجه.
Ibn Majah was not one of his students.
أبو حاتم you mentioned him in college.
Yeah, a colleague and also a student. I said they're about the same age. They took from me from each other.
All those are his students.
Yes. Allah. Yes, these are his students. These are just his famous ones. University. They should have a reunion.
Yeah, university just for the students.
Yeah. And to give some example of his knowledge, they used to go to.
محمد بن مسلم
أخذ طلبته محمد بن مسلم
محمد
بن مسلم هو
قرين
لأبي زرعة
وأبي
حاتم الرازي. Where was he living? You know,
ask where was he living.
قرين. إيه. والله ماذا يعني. This is not an all extensive list يعني. Al-Bukhari had over 9,000 students. Al-Bukhari had over 9,000 students that he read Sahih al-Jami' to. Not just Yani, 9,000 students. to give some idea of his knowledge and his memory, and he used to attend hadith lectures and not write anything, just sit there. Like some brothers do in this class. Well, after his friends, they used to give him a hard time to say, he's just wasting his time sitting there. So after 15 days, he asked them, to bring their books. And they had read over this time, they had read over 1,000 hadith. Well, Bukhari read every single hadith back to them, from his memory. Yeah. He wasn't writing anything. One scholar of hadith, his name is Al-Faryabi. He was doing something called Tadlis al-Shuyukh. This was again when Al-Bukhari was very young. He used to give an isnad and he changed all the names, uses kunya or names which are not familiar to the people in the isnad. Nicknames, kind of thing. Well, all of the students, had no idea who are the people in this chain. Until Al-Bukhari came along and for everyone he identified them correctly. And when he first visited Samarkand, 400 students of hadith gathered for 7 days to try to stump al-Bukhari. And he tried to give him some hadith, that he doesn't know, mixed the isnad. 400 students. And probably his most famous incident is when he came to Baghdad. Because by the time that he came to Baghdad, he was very well known. So all the scholars, everyone came out, to meet him. What they did, the scholars had agreed, among themselves, that they'll have 10 people, 10 scholars, go up to al-Bukhari, and each one of them will read 10 hadith to al-Bukhari. So they went up to al-Bukhari and they read 10 hadith. Well, after every hadith, al-Bukhari said, I don't know this hadith. Well, the first one finishes the 10, the next guy comes, the next sheikh comes, and he reads his 10 hadith. Well, al-Bukhari again says, I don't know any. Don't know any of these hadith. Well, the people who were listening, in the crowd, they were not Yani ulama, they were not knowing what was going on. They thought that what they had heard about al-Bukhari wasn't correct. So when they're finished, what they were actually doing is they take the hadith and they put the wrong isnad. So if you take a hadith and put the wrong isnad, then it becomes a new hadith. So after they were done, the 100 hadith, al-Bukhari said, I will tell you the hadith that I do know. So he reread all the 100 hadith with the correct isnad. Well, Ibn Hajar commenting on this, he said, the amazing thing is not that he knew the correct isnad, because he's a scholar, he should know the correct isnad. The amazing thing is he remembered all 100 hadith from the beginning after hearing it, just once.
What's the reason to do it? Just to test?
It's just a test. Well, in Al-Basra, when the first time he came to Al-Basra also, the people insisted that he give a lecture.
Did they mean to change the isnad?
Yes. They did it on purpose. And the people, the 10 scholars who were reading to him, they knew when he says, I don't know, they knew that he knows that. While the people listening, they thought, this guy doesn't know anything.
Is this kind of test, at least?
No, yani this kind of testing was not uncommon among the scholars. And it was very common. We discussed it last year in the hadith class. Well, when the first time he came to Basra, and again the people insisted that he give a lecture. So he began by saying, "O people of Basra, I am a young man, and you have asked me to narrate to you. So I'll narrate to you hadith, yani from the people of your town, that you will benefit from. And in other words, that you don't know these hadith." Well, the people yani were surprised. So he gave one hadith, and he began hadathana Abdullah ibn Uthman, who said akhbarana his father from Shu'bah, from Mansur, and others from Salim, from Anas, from the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. And he said that you people do not have this hadith from Mansur, even though Mansur was from Basra. You have it from people other than Mansur. So his whole lecture was like this, yani giving them hadith from the people of Basra that they themselves no longer had. Well, as he mentioned at the beginning, yani this was still when he was very young. Obviously, yani the scholars of his time, yani they respected him very much. They made many statements concerning him, and he's saying how much they praised him. I think it's not necessary to go over them. I'd just like to mention a little bit about his character. Al-Bukhari was very careful with respect to the books and who he gives his books to, and who he loans his books to. So one person who happened to borrow his books, and he mentioned the hadith which gave, he said something in such a way that it made the people doubt whether al-Bukhari actually heard the hadith directly or he was making some kind of tadlis. Well, tadlis is where you narrate the hadith in such a way that it makes it seem like you heard the hadith directly, but you did not. You heard it from someone else. So what happened on that occasion, since they accused him of making tadlis from a specific scholar, Al-Bukhari said that he gave up 10,000 hadith from that scholar just so people would not think that he committed tadlis. Well, on another occasion, Al-Bukhari was he was on a ship going across a river, and someone came on the ship with Al-Bukhari, and he seemed like a religious man, and they got to know each other. And so he happened to mention to this man that in his luggage he had 10,000 gold coins or something, and a large amount of gold coins. Well, the next morning this man started screaming, saying that somebody stole my gold coins. So the people on the ship started to search everyone on the ship. So Al-Bukhari, when this happened, and immediately he took the gold coins and he threw them into the river. So they checked the whole ship, they didn't find the coins anywhere. So after the journey was over, the man asked Al-Bukhari, what did you do with this money? What did you do with it? He said, I threw it into the ocean. And he asked him, why did you do that? Because for some people, to be accused of stealing and to claim that it's your money instead of money being stolen, and it's not that big of a claim for them. Al-Bukhari's answer was that all of my life I have spent in collecting and in compiling the hadith of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, and my integrity has to be confirmed. So how can I afford to lose that much greater wealth that I have acquired against being accused of being a theft? And so because of the safeguarding hadith, and that people would realize that the hadith that he's passing on are authentic, he refused to even take any chance with his honor.
So even though it was his own money?
It was his money. Yeah, he told the other man, I have 10,000. The next morning the man said, my 10,000 is stolen. So Al-Bukhari, to avoid it, he just threw the 10,000 in.
It was Al-Bukhari's money?
Yeah, it was Al-Bukhari's money. And he told the other man, I have 10,000 gold pieces. So the next morning the other man said, someone stole my 10,000 gold pieces. So Al-Bukhari immediately threw it in the river. one time one of his business partners stole about 25,000 dirhams from him. One of his business partners stole 25,000 dirhams. Well, they told al-Bukhari that he should go yani, to the governor to settle this dispute. Yani, the governor of the area, the emir. Al-Bukhari's reply was, if I do that for worldly purpose, the governor may ask me someday for a fatwa on a religious ruling. And I'm not willing to give up yani, my deen for money or the hereafter for this world. So finally, the person who took the 25,000, he settled with al-Bukhari that he'll pay him 10 dirhams a month. Obviously, yani, he would never pay. And as many other ulama, al-Bukhari went through yani, some trials near the end of his life. Yani, ibtila from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Near the end of his life, he decided to move to Nisabur. Well, the leading sheikh in Nisabur at that time was Muhammad ibn Yahya al-Dhuhli. I'm getting to it.
Oh.
This is, yani, there's not just one ibtila, there's two ibtila, yani, it happened one after the other. Well, the leading sheikh, the leading scholar in Nisabur was Muhammad ibn Yahya al-Dhuhli. Well, al-Dhuhli had heard about al-Bukhari and he encouraged the people, yani, to go out and to, yani, to greet him. And in fact, they, yani, they waited outside the city. They put up tents and they're waiting for al-Bukhari to come. So al-Bukhari was, yani, very nicely greeted when he came, when he first arrived, to Nisabur. When al-Bukhari started, yani, al-Dhuhli and the other scholars of, in Nisabur, yani, their fame or their popularity began to lessen as people yani, attended al-Bukhari's lectures. And yani, it seems that al-Dhuhli began to be yani, quite jealous of al-Bukhari. So finally the people, yani, whether al-Dhuhli himself was involved or yani, the other shuk similar to him, they finally yani, conspired against al-Bukhari with respect to the question of the creation of the Qur'an. Well, not yani, the creation of the Qur'an like at the time of Imam Ahmad, but in this case yani, they had someone go to al-Bukhari and they had him ask about what you say about yani, my wording of the Qur'an. Lafzi. Is it created or not? Well, al-Bukhari's answer, yani, first yani, he refused to answer. And because this kind of question, especially at that time, it's best not to answer. Well, finally, yani, he answered after the person persisted. So he said, the Qur'an is the speech of Allah, Kalam Allah, and it is not created. But the action of the slaves is created. And to ask about such matters is an innovation. It's bid'ah. Okay. So yani, he said that the action of the slaves, yani, is created. But he didn't say that the Kalam Allah, or the word of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, is created. But immediately, yani, the person misinterpreted what al-Bukhari said, and they said that al-Bukhari is saying that the wording of the Qur'an is created. Well, this, yani, caused lots of problems. They began to, of course, accuse him of bid'ah and so on. And he, of course, yani, always he insisted that that's not what he said. He is simply saying, yani, that the actions of the slaves are created. And even he wrote a book, yani, about the actions of the creator, of the created, yani, the actions of the slaves are created, and that book still exists today. أفعال الإباد, yani. Well, yani, finally, al-Dhuhli, he said, أفعال الإباد. Actions of the people. Abad, yeah, human beings. Not anyone's slave. Finally, al-Dhuhli, and it came to the point that he said that anyone who is going to go to al-Bukhari's lectures, he should not sit in my lecture. And he said, yani, the people have to avoid al-Bukhari. Well, his influence was such. His influence was such that everyone, yani, stopped going to al-Bukhari's lectures, except for two. The two people who continued to go to al-Bukhari's lectures were Muslim ibn al-Hajjaj and Ahmad ibn Salama. Muslim Ibn al-Hajjaj is the companion, is the author of Sahih Muslim. Ahmed ibn Salama. Well, when Abu Hali said, "Yani anyone who wants to go to al-Bukhari's lecture should not attend my lecture," immediately, Yani Imam Muslim stood up and he left. And not only that, he went to his house, he gathered all the hadith that he had from Adhuhali, he put it on a camel, and he sent it to Adhuhali's house. Well, it finally got to the point that Adhuhali said that this man and I cannot live in the same area. And finally, he was driven out of Nisabur, al-Bukhari. Well, al-Bukhari, yani, to show... al-Bukhari's honesty, yani, Imam Muslim, he refused to record any hadith from Imam Dhuhli. Well, al-Bukhari, he said, yani, Dhuhli is an honest person, yani, but he is mistaken with respect to what I said. So you'll find in Sahih al-Bukhari, you'll find hadith from Dhuhli. But he doesn't say yani Dhuhli. He says Hadathana Muhammad. His name was Muhammad. Well, some people explain this yani because he did not want to show yani that he agreed with Dhuhli, but just to give some respect to the Sheikh. But Muslim yani refused absolutely. He gave all his books back. He said yani I don't want to have anything to do with him. Well, unfortunately, two of the scholars of Hadith, Abu Hatim al-Razi and Abu Zar'a al-Razi. Yani both of them were influenced by Dhuhli, and both of them yani stopped narrating hadith from al-Bukhari. After al-Bukhara went to Nisabur, after he left Nisabur, he went to his hometown of Bukhara. And again, yani in Bukhara, he was greeted yani as he was greeted in Nisabur. Yeah. But again, yani it did not last long. In this case, it seems that al-Bukhari has problems with people with the name of Dhuhli. Because in this case, yani, the governor, his name was Khalid ibn Ahmed al-Dhuhli. Khalid asked al-Bukhari to come to the governor's mansion and to teach to his sons, yani, to give special class to his sons. Well, Bukhari replied, yani, that I shall never humiliate knowledge and I shall never carry it to the doors of the people. If he needs me, let him come to my mosque or to my house. Well, after that, yani, Dhuhli, now the governor, he asked, okay, yani, my sons will go to the mosque, but at least give them a special... don't put them in with the rest of the class. And also this, yani, he refused. So the governor of Dhuhli was upset. So he brought back the same accusations, yani with respect to the creation of Quran that were found in Nisabur. So finally, yani the governor got the people so upset that he was also finally forced to leave from al-Bukhara. Yani, and from al-Bukhara, he was headed to Samarkand. Samarkand, yani, they had written to him that he is welcome to come and lecture in Samarkand. On the way to Samarkand, he reached a town called Khartank. And if Yusuf or Fawzi were here, they could tell you, yani, where we are. When he reached this town, and he had some relatives there in that town, and when he reached this town, he heard that in Samarkand there was some dispute about whether or not al-Bukhari should come. Yani the people, some people said we don't want him to come because of supposedly yani his bid'ah, and others said yani we want him to come. So he stayed in Khartank for some time, and yani at this time he made this famous du'a, saying, "Oh Allah, your earth has become too yani tight for me, despite its vastness, and I beseech you or I ask you to take me to yourself." So he asked Allah Subhanahu wa Taala to take his life. Well, after that, shortly after that, he received the news that the people of Samarkand, yani, want him to come. They agreed that they want him to come. So he got ready to go to Samarkand, and he had just gone a little distance, and he was too ill, and finally he died.
On the way to
Yani he just in Khartank, and he didn't even leave the city yet. Well, he died on the night of Eid al-Fitr. Well, he was buried on the first of Shawwal. That was in 256 after the Hijrah. Well, as I said, with respect to Imam Muslim, very little is known about Imam Muslim. Yeah, and the most we know about Imam Muslim is what he had to do with al-Bukhari. His name is Muslim ibn al-Hajjaj al-Qushayri al-Nisaburi. He was born either in the year 204 or 206. Hatta even the year he was born, we don't know. Most likely he was born in 206. And he came from the city of Nisabur, which was at that time one of the greatest and most scholarly cities in the Muslim world. And it seems that his father was some kind of faqih or some kind of sheikh. He began his studies of hadith, according to a Dhahabi, in the year 218 when he was 12 years old. And he was, by the way, also a little bit rich, like al-Bukhari. This is when he began Sama'a hadith. So he was free to pursue his knowledge or pursue his studies of hadith. Well, as was the custom at that time, he traveled to many areas, similar to al-Bukhari. Some of his teachers that he studied under in different areas are Qutayba ibn Sa'id, Yahya ibn Yahya al-Naysaburi, Ishaq ibn some of the shuyukh, Ishaq ibn Rahaway Rahuya. Now Muhaddithin do not like Rahaway because Way is the name of Shaitan in Farsi. So they say Rahuya. But it seems his name is Rahaway. And if you've got a
And the Dhuhri for a while.
قلنا توقع ممكن في درس ترد ان الدرس كله شيخ بالانجليزي بعد ما يقرا الشيخ
لا ليه بس يوم قال الشيطان عرفته انا يقول هواي يكثر
وايد Also, his teachers also included Ahmed ibn Hanbal, Walid ibn Muslim. Perhaps his most famous student is At-Tirmidhi. I don't know. There's many names here. Walid ibn Muslim. Walid ibn Muslim is famous for one thing. He's famous for committing tabliz. Although he was thiqa when he's not committing tabliz. Those are for the people in the hadith class from last year. Tabliz is where you make some deception in. For example, I have met Ali al-Hakimi many times. Okay? Suppose I hear hadith from Abu Sa'ud from Ali al-Hakimi. So, when I narrate this hadith, I should be honest that I heard it from Abu Sa'ud from Ali al-Hakimi. If I do not mention Abu Sa'ud's name and I just say An Ali, this is tadlis. Okay? This is one type of tadlis. This is the worst type of tadlis because you're leaving someone out of the chain. Like in this case, he might not be thaqa. So we have to. Now this is Tadlis al-Isnad. Tadlis al-Shuyukh is where you change the name, like the al-Faryabi, when he changed the name and used kunya and nicknames, so people don't know who he's talking about. This is Tadlis al-Shuyukh. The method and Abu Saud, if you don't. Ulla and Abu Bandr. And Abu Bandr. Something like this. Well, besides that, and what he happened to do with Dhuhli, as I said, there's not much known about Imam Muslim. except we know that he continued to travel and search for hadith until just before he died. Yani he was always in a process of studying hadith. Well, he died in the year 261. And he also has many works other than Sahih Muslim, especially in Asma al-Rajal.
What was the name of the city you said that from Nisabur?
Nisabur.
Yeah. What? I remember that.
Close to Bukhara.
Gave us a quiz.
A quiz?
Yeah. What is the name of Kitab Sahih?
No, this is about al-Bukhari or al-Tirmidhi. Okay, that's the next point. Now we're moving on to Sahih al-Bukhari. I said there's five areas, yani, we will cover if we have time. Yani the lives of al-Bukhari or Muslim, and then Sahih al-Bukhari and Sahih Muslim. Then yani a comparison between the two, and then we'll do the criticisms of the two. Well, if we don't have time next time, yani we'll skip everything else and go directly to the criticisms. Because this is where the question came up originally. So, and before the time of al-Bukhari, if you're familiar, as those of you who were in the hadith class last year are, with how books were, yani the history of the written literature of hadith, you find, for example, during the time of the Sahaba, there were some personal collections of hadith. Yani that people kept for their own use. And then after that time, yani the next stage was basically collections which included hadith and also reports from the Sahaba and from the Tabi'in and so forth. Like Al-Muwatta is a classic example of that. Al-Muwatta, yani is not... now if you lock the door, mashallah.
Nobody, man, would you please open it?
And Al-Muwatta of Imam Malik is here. It is not just a collection of hadith, yani it has many reports other than of just hadith. So therefore the next stage after that then was people collecting just hadith. These works are known as Musnad. And just hadith of the Prophet ﷺ, do not include any reports from the Sahaba and Tabi'in. And the next step after that would be to include just hadith which are only authentic hadith. And so you see the four stages that the recording of hadith went through. Four, any personal collections of the Sahaba, collections that contain reports from everyone, and then just hadith of the Prophet ﷺ, and then finally just authentic hadith. Well, the first one to make a collection of just authentic hadith was who? Was al Bukhari. And what was the name of his work? You're very close, actually. You forgot one word, which is al Mukhtasar.
Well, it has two names.
No.
Two reports about the name.
Maybe now, but not before, yeah. No, some people may have forgotten to put the word in Mukhtasar. Abdul Khalaq Abdul Ghani and Imam Bukhari was Sahihu. Tayyib. I will not argue with him yet. Where did he go? He left. What is the name of the book again? This time include the Mukhtasar. There's no من أمور رسول الله وسننه وأيامه. Okay. The reason al-Bukhari, yani what led him to collect this hadith, is one time his sheikh Ishaq ibn Rahaway told his students that I wish that one of you would make an abridged collection, an mukhtasar collection of the authentic sunnah of the Prophet. So this idea struck al-Bukhari's mind, and he started to compile the work. And he said, I collected the jama', from 100,000 hadith over a course of 16 years. And I have said it as a proof for hujjah between me and Allah.
Wonderful, 16 years.
Yeah, and it took him 16 years to compile it.
Too little.
He also said, Yani, I never put any hadith in this work except that I washed first and made two and raqatain of salat, asking for guidance for every hadith. Yeah. So he must have completed the work by the year 233, because he showed the entire work to Yahya bin Ma'in for his approval. Well, Yahya died in the year 233. Well, Bukhari died in the year 256. So this year means, yani, for 23 years, the work was completed for 23 years, yani, which gave time for al-Bukhari to read it to, as I said, over 9,000 students. And also gave him time, yani, for if there was any mistake in the work, for anyone to perhaps correct it or to go through it.
Could you repeat the last point?
Yani, he finished the work in 233. He died in 256. So this left him, yani, with two, yani, he finished the work by 233, maybe earlier than that. So he had at least 23 years which to read the hadith, to read the book to his students, and as I said, over 9,000 students. And also it gave, yani, gave people 23 years to criticize the work. And if there's any shortcomings in the work, they had their chance. Well, the name of the book implies many things about the book itself. The first word in the book is Jam, which means what in this context?
It covers all topics.
Okay, Jama here means it covers all the topics related to the deen. And from Iman to Tahara to Salat to what will happen on the Day of Judgment and so forth. And this is different from books like Sunan Abu Dawud or Sunan Tirmidhi. Because Sunan Abu Dawud wa Tirmidhi, they only include hadith which have legal bearing to it. In general, yani. Well, the next word is sahih, which means, yani, that these are authentic hadith. As we said, yani, I only included hadith in this work which are authentic. Well, al-musnad, what does al-musnad mean here?
Al-musnad, going back
to the Prophet. Okay. These are the hadith that go back to the Prophet with a complete chain. Musnad means both, marfu' and muttasil. Goes back to the Prophet and has a complete chain. Marfu' means goes back to the Prophet even with a broken chain. Muttasil means the chain is unbroken. So musnad means both, marfu' wa muttasil. So what he's saying here is that the hadith of al-Bukhari which are sahih are those hadith which are marfu' and muttasil. And this is an important point, and we'll get back to that again. The title is telling you that what he's calling the sahih hadith are those hadith which are both marfu' and muttasil.
Person is missing from the chain,
then it's not Muslim.
So you are saying marfu' is where one person is missing?
No, marfu' means it goes back to the Prophet. It's traced back to the Prophet.
Yeah,
but it could be traced with a broken chain or with a complete chain.
If it's a broken chain, that means it's not sahih.
Well, that's another question. The point is, if it is a broken chain, you still call it marfu'ah if it goes back to the Prophet. If it is something that they claim the Prophet sent. For example, if I say now, an Rasulullah, and I don't give you any isnad, and in my statement is still, I'm claiming it is marfu'ah. But the chain is not muttasil. Now, if I give you a complete chain back to the Sahaba, the chain is muttasil, but the hadith or the statement is not marfu'ah. So musnad means both, yani muttasil wa marfu'. Wa al-mukhtasir, yani meaning that, yani it was not Imam al-Bukhari's intention to include every hadith which is sahih. Okay. It was never his intention to include every hadith which is sahih.
I wish he did.
What that means is that if a hadith is not in Sahih al-Bukhari, it does not mean it is not sahih. Okay. Some people recently, like last Ramadan, writing in Sharq al-Awsat, yani is talking about one particular hadith, is saying that this hadith isn't authentic. And one of the claims, yani one of the proofs that this hadith isn't authentic is that it's not in Sahih al-Bukhari or Sahih Muslim.
What's the hadith?
The hadith about the Ummah will break into 73 sects. Yani whether it is in al-Bukhari or Muslim, yani or not, or if it is not in al-Bukhari or Muslim, this does not mean it is not sahih. That is also an important point, yani not to be confused by it. So now we come to the number of hadith in Sahih Bukhari. How many hadith does it contain? Well, if you just finished Abdul Khaliq's book, then you should. Nam.
More.
Sounds good. Yeah, he collected it from 100,000. From those 100,000, he took. Yes, there's many different versions. طيب, Al-Bukhari, one thing you should realize about Al-Bukhari, which is much different from Sahih Muslim, is that Al-Bukhari also is a book of fiqh. Okay? Al-Bukhari used to use the same hadith many times if it fits under different verbs, if it fits under different chapters. Okay? So what that means is there's lots of repetition in Sahih Bukhari. The same hadith you'll find it many, many times. And sometimes you won't find it, you'll find part of it here and part of it there. You won't know it's the same hadith unless you know the hadith. This is different from Imam Muslim. Imam Muslim, yani, records every hadith completely, but he records it only once. So for example, yani, there might be a hadith about Dajjal. They mention something else, yani, before Dajjal. So he'll put it in the chapter, yani, which is related to the other topic. So if you look under Dajjal and you think, you know, you're positive that Imam Muslim recorded this hadith. So you look under Dajjal and you look everywhere, you'll not find it. Because he only records the hadith once. So yani, it is under the other topic. But that's different
like,
with...
Like yellow pages and white pages.
I can see you really benefited from Abu Khalik's book. طيب, the number of hadith in Sahih Bukhari with with repetition. Okay, again, there's lots of different opinion, as Ahmed said. I'll give you an idea how big the difference of opinion are. Ibn Hajar says with repetition the number is 9,082. And actually, when we talk about repetition, yani, that's a mistake, by the way. It just occurred to me that they're making a mistake here. Yes, because many times they come with different isnad. And according to the muhadithin, the same hadith, the same matan with different isnad is a different hadith. Yeah.
But not for the fuqaha.
Yeah, well, Ibn Hajar is not... he should have kept this point in mind. Ibn Kathir says, in his Mukhtasar Ulum al-Hadith, which was the text, if you remember last year, it was the text, Ba'at al-Hadith, Sharh Mukhtasar Ulum al-Hadith. Ahmed Shakir, that's right. It was Sharh of Ibn Kathir's book. And I'm sure you all remember in that book, Ibn Kathir says there's 7,275 hadith in al-Bukhari.
275.
No, this is with repetition. Now, if you take out all the repetition and just worried about the text, Those you can read pretty well. Those separate yani texts with complete chains come to 2,602. 2,602.
What is
this? This is the number of hadith in Sahih Bukhari without repetition, but with complete chains. 602. Know what I said? The hadith that he has without complete chain, okay, he has some hadith without complete chain, they are 159. Hadith without complete chain. different hadith without complete chain.
This is
with
repetition.
Yeah.
With repetition.
Now these are any hadith without repetition and without complete chain. 159, not muttasil, غير muttasil. These are called the mu'alaqat of Sahih al-Bukhari. Unbroken. Broken. Without complete chain is what I said. I didn't say broken or unbroken. 159. Okay, these are the mu'alaqat of Sahih al-Bukhari. They are hadith without complete chain. Now, from the title of Sahih al-Bukhari's work, what can we say about these hadith without complete chain? As-sahih al-musnad. Yani he is saying that all of the hadith that have complete chains and go back to the Prophet ﷺ are sahih. So those that do not have complete chains, what can we say about them? Yes, the mu'allaqat. Yeah, we cannot say yani immediately. We have to check. Okay.
I understood it differently.
طيب about the mu'alaqat. Yani many times in Sahih Bukhari, if you just open up almost any page in Sahih Bukhari and you read the chapter title, especially chapter title, okay, read this chapter title.
باب قراءة فاتحة الكتاب على الجنازة. وقال الحسن يقرأ على الطفل بفاتحة الكتاب ويقول اللهم اجعله لنا فرطا وسلفا وأجرا.
طيب the English is the recitation of Surah Al-Fatiha and the funeral prayer. Al-Hasan said, recite Al-Fatiha and the funeral prayer for a child, and then say, oh Allah, make him as the one who prepares the way for us and a source of reward for us. It seems the Bahr. Okay. And if you open up to almost any bab, if you read this bab, I'm just flipping any around.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Bab Qiyam al-Nabi sallallahu alayhi wa sallam al-Layl. فقالت عائشة رضي الله عنها كان يقوم حتى تفطر قدماه والفطور الشقوق انفطرت انشقت.
English version. Standing of the Prophet for the prayer night. Aisha narrated that the Prophet صلى الله عليه وسلم used to pray till his feet used to be swollen. Okay. Yeah, they put the Greek automatus, but no one's going to know what automatus means, so they put swollen. bleeding.
Cracked.
Dave, anyway, what about this bab, that chapter heading? What do you have there? You have hadith marfu', right? But there's no isnad whatsoever. He just said, qalat Aisha. He did not give the isnad, he just said, Aisha said. This is يعني, an example of a mu'alliq hadith in Sahih Bukhari. The other one from Al-Hasan also is Mu'alliq Hadith. Okay, now.